even now, taking up his books and reading them, you know, with a nice attitude. Wow. Prabhupada's there.
Very
accessible.
So, Upadeshamrita, how many of you have a copy of this? Very nice book. Are you available in your store?
Yeah. It's because our whole movement is coming down. We're a very long tradition, full of potency, all the way back to Krishna. And so about 500 years ago, of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, on the altar on the left there, appeared in this line coming from Krishna and was presenting proper explanation of Krishna consciousness, of the Bhagavad Gita, of Krishna's ideas in terms of the time, place, and circumstance. And of course, we understand he's actually Krishna himself, come as Gauranga Mahaprabhu. And among his chief disciples was Rupa Goswami. So on the altar, somewhere here, we have a picture of six Goswamis. It's up on the wall behind us there also. Rupa, Sanatan. And these are very, very powerful, intelligent personalities. Rupa and Sanatan Goswami were actually the prime ministers of Nawab Hussain Shah in Bengal. In that time, he was ruling, I guess, all of Bengal. You know, Bengal was like, I don't know, the size of something. Big state in India. And rich in spices, jewels, silk, medical knowledge, all these things, architecture. There's probably no place in the world now as opulent as Bengal was at that time. So the prime minister for all of this was Rupa and his brother Sanatan. But they renounced everything to follow Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and adopt his philosophy, his culture, his process of ecstatic congregational chanting of the glories of the Lord in the mood of the gopis. Okay. And then he also wrote so many books, you know, beautiful books explaining all this, and song books, and acrostics, and little puzzles, word puzzles, and so many things, so many ways. You know. So he summarized everything he knew in 11 verses. And here it is right here in front of you. Upadesh Amrita, the essence of all advice. And Prabhupada says this constitutes first instructions for neophyte devotees. So it's a very, very nice place to start in terms of a systematic study. Because even in 100 years, we can't really study all the literature that A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami gave us, coming down from this tradition. So you have to find your place. This book was very, very excellent instruction. So in 11 verses, Rupa Goswami goes to what is reality on it to the highest level. He starts off with the Vacho Vegam, Manasa, Karoda Vegam, Jiva Vegam. Yeah. He starts off talking about controlling the tongue, right? In the Southwest Airlines magazine, the biggest airlines in the United States, they have a passengers magazine, and it says, the average man speaks 2,000 words a day. The average woman speaks
7,000.
But if you're talking about Krishna, you're way ahead of the guys. Yeah. So everybody, even frogs, Baba says, want to talk. There's so many nerves. My background's in psychology. There's so much innervation in the mouth and the fingers like that. And so if you're a human being, so if you're talking, this the whole body becomes stimulated and you have the kind of bhava, feeling you want. So it's hearing, singing, like that. So the tongue, even in the Bible says, if you meet a man who has controlled his tongue, you have met a perfected man. Yeah. So two functions, talking and tasting. Yeah, it all starts there. You're fasting for your health or whatever. And you just go by some coffee shop and you're smelling coffee and of course you're blowing out the smell of fresh pastries and your water starts to flow in your mouth and that is very well. I'll just go in and look, but I won't taste it. You start tasting a little bit of that, a little bit of coffee, a little bit. And what do you know? Vacho Vegam, Jiva Vegam? Your stomach starts to become agitated then. And you want to satisfy your stomach in different ways. Okay. And then? Upasta. Every Italian knows when you have too much pasta, wine. Yeah. So this is a universal fact. This is a universal truth. That's a Hare Krishna thing. You'll find it everywhere. that first you lose control of your tongue, then you lose control of your stomach, then you lose control of your genitals, and you go to hell. I can see that. It's just straight down there. So how to keep the tongue under control? Like by offering all your victuals, is that a word in Australia? Victuals is an American cowboy word. All your food, you know, whatever comestibles you have before, cook them with the idea that I'm going to offer this to God, and then I'm going to also take it as His crumbs from His plates, crumbs from the Lord's plate. With that attitude, we have some higher consciousness then. I'm not just eating for a gross reason. One Englishman, he sees three people doing the same thing. And he goes to the first guy and he says, what are you doing? And the guy says, can't you see, you damn fool? I'm laying bricks. Okay, thank you. He goes to the second guy and he says, well, what are you doing? We're all doing the same thing. And he says, well, I'm making money. Just take care of my family. Okay, thank you. And he goes to the third person. He says, what are you doing? And he says, oh, it's very interesting. We're building this church now. And today we're putting up the wall that goes behind the altar. And in a few days, the marble masons will come and hang the marble here, a great beautiful marble. And my children are very small now. But when they're bigger, I'm going to bring them here and help show them how I helped to build this great cathedral. Right? So I'm doing the same thing. But how broad is the consciousness? How broad is the consciousness? So this is our point, is that we're caught in this lower consciousness. By the tongue can take us down, but the tongue can also take us up. Simply tasting the food offered to Krishna. And right away, Prabhupada said one time, in his mother's kitchen, everything was so clean. While she was cleaning, she was cooking, she was cleaning. And so when the offering went on the altar for Krishna, everything was clean. It was a couple of seconds. It wasn't that Janmashtami, there's wet rags hanging out of the sink and the stuff here and everything else. Big offer, the offer goes to the altar in the kitchen. Looks like World War III or something. Normandy invasion or something. Save fire Ryan or something. Because the consciousness is what you're eating. The consciousness is there so much. So if the conscious, Baba says, if you eat prasadam prepared in the kitchen like that, immediately you feel refreshed, energized. So cooking with a high consciousness, I'm offering this to the Supreme Lord. Learn who He is, learn more about Him. And then your consciousness will be higher. And then the second thing, tasting and talking. Okay, always hearing and chatting about God, about Krishna, about some elevated subject matter. And then if you're always talking about Krishna and always tasting Krishna prasad, and your whole life is basically perfect. You've been a perfected person. But it's a whole science. If chemistry is a science, if physics are sciences, what to speak of theology? Yeah? But why is it such a mess? Because it's so difficult. So difficult to actually do it properly. So Rupa Goswami, he gives us this very wonderful essence of all advice. It takes 3 minutes. We did a program at Oxford one time, and we had a poster of Rupa Goswami looking, kind of black and white mystical posters sitting like that. And it said, three minutes with a genius. Of course, you better walk you by in Oxford. What is that? I'm the only genius. 3 minutes with a genius. And we said, Rupa Goswami and his followers dominated the world of 15th century Bengali metaphysics. He was a great prime minister, left everything to follow Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and live like a hermit and saint. But he summarized all of his knowledge, thousands of verses. He summarized them in 11 verses. Come tonight and spend 3 minutes with a genius. Okay. People came. They were ready to debate, who a genius was. So very, very nice book. He starts off with a very simple process. We have to control our senses. Socrates says, Confucius says, Lao Tzu says, Muhammad says, Shakespeare says, what's it, Cervantes says, okay. Everybody says, you got to control your senses, otherwise you're going to be in trouble. So then after that he goes to different higher and higher processes in Bhakti Yoga very quickly. The heart of all of our literature is the Bhagavad Purana, back in the bookcase there. Of course, it's thousands of years old, it's actually eternal. and it's composed of 18,000 verses, right? So here we have the whole thing condensed into 11 verses. So you got to figure it's going to go pretty fast. Yeah. But it's an overview. It's an overview. You can find out where you're at. Because everybody's at a different level of spiritual development. But we're carrying on this for several lifetimes like that. So there's one verse in here in the purports. The commentaries are incredible. These are coming down from Rupa Goswami, explaining the verses a little bit more. And so it's a very, very nice book. It's actually very important, essential to our movement. So in text number 3, he's talking about enthusiasm, and the acharyas, Prabhupada, the purport, quote, Bhagavad Gita 9:4. It's the essential verse for Bhagavad Gita. So here's a piece. Maya,
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 Tatam,
Tatam,
Idam,
Idam,
Sarvam,
Sarvam,
Maya, Tatam, Idam, Sarvam,
Maya, Tatam, Idam, Sarvam,
Maya, Tatam, Idam, Sarvam,
Maya, Tatam, Idam, Sarvam,
Jagat,
Jagat,
Avyakta,
Avyakta,
Murtina,
Murtina,
Jagat, Jagat, Avyakta, Murtina,
Jagat, Avyakta, Murtina,
Jagat, Avyakta, Murtina,
Jagat, Avyakta, Murtina,
Maya Tatam Idam Sarvam,
Maya Tatam Idam Sarvam,
Jagat Avyakta Murtina,
Jagat Avyakta Murtina,
Matstani,
Matstani,
Sarvabhutani,
Sarvabhutani,
Matstani, Sarvabhutani,
Matstani, Sarvabhutani,
Nachaham,
Nachaham,
Teshu,
Teshu,
Avastitaha,
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 Nachaham,
Nachaham,
Teish Vavastitaha,
Teish Vavastitaha,
Teish Vavastitaha,
Teish Vavastitaha,
Maya Tatam Idam Sarvam,
Maya Tatam Idam Sarvam,
Jagata Vyakta Murtena,
Jagata Vyakta Murtena,
Matstani Sarvabhutani,
Matstani Sarvabhutani,
Nachaham Teish Vavastitaha,
Nachaham Teish Vavastitaha.
So if somebody asks you if you know Sanskrit, you can say, a little bit. Or else you can also say, I have a practical knowledge of it. Yeah. Many, many big technical Sanskritist experts don't have a practical knowledge. Seems like they're fun back. Okay, so Krishna says, by me, in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. By me, in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. Okay. Under the direction, Prabhupada says, the bona fide spiritual master, one has to make everything favorable, favorable, favorable for Krishna's service. For example, at present we are using a dictaphone, Prabhupada says. The materialists who invented this machine intended it for businessmen or writers of mundane fiction. Yeah. So, subject matters. He certainly never thought of using the dictaphone in God's service. But we are using this dictaphone to write Krishna conscious literature. So this is the very, very essential verse, right? We have to be able to take everything in this world and see how it's connected to Krishna. And then we are enthusiastic. And everything can be connected to Krishna. Tobacco, can it be connected to Krishna?
Indirectly. Indirectly.
Directly.
Directly.
Yes, it's a very, very good herb for bruises. Yeah. Traditionally, people would chew on it and put it on a bruise. It would suck all the contamination out like that. But God never expected you to smoke this stuff. In the world, there are so many nuclear rockets, right? Yeah. How can we use those in Krishna's service? I have an idea. Okay, on Janmashtami, there's a big competition between Russia and everybody else to shoot their rockets off in outer space and spell off Jai Shri Krishna. And that's the end of all the rockets in a very good way. It'd be a very beautiful light show, a show like that. One final great fireworks show. Everybody says, we don't need these things anymore. You know, higher level of consciousness. So everything can be connected to Krishna's service because everything comes from Krishna. And everything is meant for his pleasure, his satisfaction. So the point that is really is to wake people up to this. You know, wake people up to their real nature, their real self, their real satisfaction, their real service. Because again, the material world, we're trying to serve our tongue, we're trying to serve our bellies, we're trying to have a wife or a husband so we can increase the service to our tongue and belly. So many things, a nation, a community. You know, but Krishna is the real important. So how to connect all these things up? How to communicate this? So tonight, I think our lecture has been advertised as...
Carl Jung, Encounter with Eastern Mysticism.
Okay, yeah. Encounter of Carl Jung with Eastern Mysticism. How many people here know who Carl Jung is? Raise your hand. A few. Okay. He's a very, very powerful person in the history of Western psychology. He was associate of Freud, although then he had very serious disagreements about fundamental principles of ideology that Freud was developing. So Prabhupada, when he came to the West, he was trying different projects to try and connect different people to Krishna. He had prasadam. With prasadam, you can connect dogs to Krishna. You can connect cats to Krishna with prasadam. So many people, bacteria, and different things, you know, from very beautiful aesthetic things, dresses, and all these kind of things. The gift store in Los Angeles is popular even with Hollywood movie stars come there because they have high-class musical instruments, ornaments for the house, beautiful clothes, dresses, saris. Some people come, they buy stuff there. And they go to Govinda's restaurant, you know. Then after that, after a few times, they begin to ask about the monastery and, yeah, can we go there? Are there programs for the public? So many ways to get people out of this confusion that we're in, the big mess that we're in. United Nations estimates, you know, very good resource, that every year 1 million people kill themselves. Right. Yeah. How many people here are thinking of killing themselves? You might think about it. It's like actually doing it. Yeah. This, of course, doesn't talk about, again, the number of people who are thinking about it. This is more than all the wars in the world combined. All these wars going on we hear about. You know? So political science we need, how to get rid of these wars. But even more than that, we need psychology, how to deal with our own mind, our own satisfaction, our own desire. So Prabhupada also was doing a book called Dialectical Spiritualism. Have you heard about this? Yeah. And he had Shamasundar and Hayagriva present different Western philosophers and their ideas, summarizing. And they were traveling over, over many months, Prabhupada would make his commentary from our perspective on these different Western philosophies. And people have commented, I guess scholars, that Hayagriva and Shamasundar, as I understand the situation, weren't accurately really extracting the ideas all that accurately and so on. So not published in the book much more because it contains these discrepancies. But Prabhupada likes Socrates, right? Socrates. Alfred North Whitehead. You heard of him? He was the Santana Professor of Philosophy at Harvard University. He was Bertrand Russell, Nobel Laureate's guru originally. So he said, very nice person. He said the safest way to characterize all of Western philosophy is to say that the whole thing is a footnote to Socrates. So many things discussed on the immortality of the soul, what is this body, who are we, like that. You see, so many arguments that we use, probably everybody else, around Socrates also gives them. And Socrates gives credit to ancient sources also. So very, very nice stuff. The Phaedo, it's the very, very last dialogue where the hemlock is there. It's very nice to read, very stimulating, his ideas. So Prabhupada liked Socrates. Then after that, his disciple Plato and his disciple Aristotle, he's got a little bit more materialistic as it came down like that. And actually Aristotle became the guru for Western civilization, to St. Thomas Aquinas. We're all following his ideas of chopping everything up and understanding it and bringing it analytically, as opposed to trying to understand nature by cooperating with it and serving it. So there's a whole history of our thoughts, our ideas, and where we're at, and how we look at reality. So a prophet like Socrates, he said he was a good boy, just didn't have a guru. He was the last honest man in Western philosophy, and they killed him. So after that, there's so many Western philosophies, and Prabhupada was criticizing, no this, not that, no that. And it comes down, for example, to Kant, Immanuel Kant, the famous guy. If you look in the Britannic, other places, you see some people consider him to be the most important philosopher in Western history. And Kant was coming along with the idea that you cannot see the world without starting with certain intellectual tools. I think he called them categories. Like one of them was you have to be able to isolate things. If you know psychology, you just have no intelligence. You just see for example, people at 30 years old, maybe 1930, they have congenital cataracts. So they're born with light going in, the organs developing. They never developed, the actual visual perception. They knew everything, a glass of water, a book. So they had surgery, took off the bandages. Well, that's what a book looks like. Well, that's what a person knows. What they saw was a booming, buzzing confusion. They had to learn how to see straight lines. They had to learn how to see circles. They had to learn how to isolate things like that. We don't realize how much subconscious intelligence is there in developing the world we're seeing. It's incredible. Incredible. So anyway, then after a while they see squares, they see all these things like that. So Kant was making certain categories have to be there before you can see the world. For example, you have to be able to isolate things into different groups and so on. Okay. So Western philosophy, but Prabhupada also had his criticism of Kant. So finally they're going through all these people, Freud, everything else, and they come to Carl Gustav Jung. I think he was about 30 years old when Prabhupada was born. So he was born about 1866. And he was born in some small Swiss town up in the mountains with, people singing with the word, what's your name? Sound of Music with somebody. The hills are alive with the sound of music. It's a nice movie. You have to watch some movie. It's like pretty good. Julie Andrews. It's a funny movie. It's a good movie. Very nice. So anyway, it was a beautiful place up in the mountains with fresh air in Switzerland. And his father was like a Presbyterian or something, minister and so on. And at that time, if you were crazy, it was just tough luck. If you had some psychotic program going on and people haunting you, if your family was rich enough, they would toss you into a more civilized mental hospital. They'd be chained to a bed and they'd throw water on you once a week and put some food in front of you. It was not a good situation. Some places they would kill people, crazy people, they would just beat them to death or something like that. Crazy people. So it wasn't a good time. But when Jung was growing up, they started to think, well, we've been able to identify diseases and hidden causes, so maybe we can also do the same thing with psychology. There's reasons behind these things. Because previous people, the Greeks and so on, had some idea of the structure of the mind, the structure of intelligence. You find many, many very ancient paintings where they're describing as analyzing the world, the angels and devils and so on. So it was there. So he entered in as a doctor into psychiatry with Professor Bühler, and Bühler was starting all this. And they developed techniques like free association. I say a word, you say whatever comes into your mind. Money.
Youth.
Okay, youth. Blue.
White.
White.
Red.
Wife.
Husband.
Okay. We don't do this because it's sometimes very surprising. Oops. Wife. Filth. I didn't know she was filth because she's very clean. She eliminates filth. But you, by these techniques, you can start to get beyond the gross mind. They're great techniques, scientific techniques. Another one, of course, is the inkblots. Rorschach ink blots. What do you see? I see spiders. What do you see? I see spiders. What do you see? Because you can project into them. It will cut my time. We really want to tomorrow night, so the introduction tonight. So anyway, there's a very, very good book. It's called, you look on the Amazon or whatever, it's called the Tavistock Lectures, T-A-V-I, Tavistock Lectures. And the Tavistock Foundation is still in London, still organizing very intellectual encounters. So Yuma was invited to lecture there for several days. And he talked all about his view of the mind, psychology, analytical psychology. This is after World War I, before World War II. And he talks, for example, case studies. Okay, so one girl was in the mental hospital, maybe like 25 years old, 26 years old. Very, very, what's the word, autistic and not talking much to people and stuff. And so he started dealing with her. She reciprocated enough on the free association test and stuff to start like dealing with it. And things started coming up again and again. Water, child, you know, this and stuff and so on. So he went on like this and finally started talking to her, asking her questions. And she was terrified of certain things. And he'd say, it's okay, I'm your friend. And establishing a personal relationship. So after a long time, it finally all came out, what had happened. She was a young girl, maybe like in a small town in Switzerland, and she was from a lower middle income family. But she was in love with the rich man's son. It's a kind of archetypal story. She was in love with the rich man's son, but she thought, I can never, he'll never take any interest in me, I'll never marry him. So some other boy came along and asked her to get married. He was a nice guy, okay. So maybe like about, you know, maybe 2 years later or something, 3 years later, 2 years later, she was at her husband's house in another town, and one of her friends came to visit her. And in that town, one horse had fallen into the reservoir and died and stuff, so they were said, don't drink the water in the reservoir for a few days because there's typhoid and stuff. So her friend came to her and talking, and she had one little girl was playing, another baby was in the bathtub, and she couldn't bathe her baby. And her friend said, you know, you broke so-and-so's heart. The rich man's son, why? He wanted to marry you. Young girl was as dust to your mind. He wanted to marry you, oh God. And so she got this news and everything else, and here she's entangled. And her friend leaves. And her little baby is sitting there in the tub and starts sucking on the sponge, right? Now she knows the water has typhoid, and the baby is sucking on the sponge and drinking it, and she just sat and watched, and the baby got typhoid and died. Is this enough to drive you crazy? Yeah, what's one little more? Yeah, the rich man loved you, you married somebody else, and now after this, you murdered your baby, you know? Okay, is this a good cause to go crazy? No? Yes. Well, E.D., R.D. Lang, great big psychologist, he's also a very good person to read. The Politics of Experience, The Voice of Experience. He said, but it fits right into his philosophy. Insanity is usually a sane reaction to an insane situation. Put anybody here in a mental hospital for a few weeks, you'll go nuts. Everybody around you is crazy. The only sane thing to do is to be crazy. So. And in psychology developed out of science in North America, and also here, but in Spain and South America it developed out of philosophy. So they have the same idea, that there are no crazy people, there are just people in the wrong situation. The wrong social situation. It's our idea too. Sanjayate kama. Our desires and ambitions develop in the company we keep. So anyway, then he started the girls finally trusting him and bringing out and talking about it. He's not gonna whatever. And so finally it came down to the point where she realized, he was asking her, could you have stopped yourself? And at some point you can't. The emotion is so strong and everything else, you're just paralyzed by it. And she was really thought about it and everything else, and kind of came to the conclusion that maybe she could have done more, she could have done something, but it wasn't all that clear. And maybe she was just in a grip of something which a young girl couldn't handle, her whole life and so on, her ambitions. And after that, we talked about it, and she made certain commitments about how I'm going to live my life and what I'm going to do, and take responsibility for what I've done. Ram tells Lakshman, there's no mistake you can make that you can't correct, right? It's a very, very useful thing to know. You've got to pay for it, you've got to make the adjustments and stuff, but at a certain point, you rob some money from your friend or something to do something, you know, he doesn't know where it went, maybe $3,000. So after 5 years, you see, I'm the guy who took that money, here's $25,000 back. He says, rob me again. Still for me again. Okay. Yeah, and I can understand, and so on. So there's no mistake you can make that you can't correct. So she went ahead and lived her life through this. So this is one of the case studies in the book on the Tavistock Lectures. So anyway, Jung is showing up in Prabhupada's dialectical spiritualism, and they're presenting his philosophy, his ideas, and Prabhupada's saying, well, that is correct. He said, yes, that is also a good idea. That is correct. And, well, that is not correct. Then Shamasundar would explain a little more, and Prabhupada would say, well, from that perspective, yes, it is also correct. So Jung was paid, to go. Somebody else went with him, and they paid too. To the 50th anniversary of the University of Calcutta. Of course, he's not even English. The British paid for him to go. And while he was there, he had five doctorates and so on. He had so much experience, contact with India and any place else. He was there at the same time Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was, the acharya and present. And many things. He was a very, very advanced personality in his consciousness. Prabhupada said, and Shamasundar said, well, Prabhupada, he's the last one. And Prabhupada said, of all of them, he has the most sense. Okay? So, mayatatam vidam sarvam, we're trying to connect everybody, every community. My background, my nature, not your background, not your nature. Everybody's different. Everybody's got to develop their own sankirtan. Everybody's got to become a guru, right? On Lord Chaitanya's order, and communicate to the people that you can communicate with, your ability. We can all give a general discussion, okay, yeah. But then specifically, myself, some very beautiful young girl comes in the temple room and asks me about Krishna consciousness. I say, well, it's like a very, very beautiful Indian religion and so on. Let me find one of the ladies to talk with you. So I'm not going to be talking to beautiful young girls about them. The same way you may be talking to handsome women with big mustaches and so on. No, it's like, women can talk to women, children can talk to children. I've seen that. Kids, teenagers and stuff can get the message across to other teenagers a lot better than the 70-year-old guy. Dogs preach to dogs. Have you seen that? The dogs went along with the Haryana party. Okay, so develop your preaching, your sankirtan, your service to Prabhupada. Become your little ray of Srila Prabhupada, reaching so many people. So we've been developing this. Different programs have been developing for some time. So, and it's been successful. For example, I tried Vastu for a while, architecture. That was good. I can give a university-level introductory course in Vastu. I read D.N. Shukla's two books and stuff. Yeah, but then I saw that if I wanted to go on, then I had to become, read more Western architecture. So back and forth, and finally I'm coming around to my background. I graduated first place in psychology from the University of California in 1970 with minor studies in biology and electrical engineering. Okay, yeah. Then they went on, stuff, and finally I reached the limit of Western psychology and went into karate, and they call it Okinawan karate, and improvisational theater, which is very elevated. And finally came in contact with Prabhupada. Okay, yeah. So then, started investigating the psychology community and the Jungian psychology. Yeah, it's practically speaking, the most advanced community of psychologists. Like Prabhupada says, of all that have the most sense. There are people who believe that we are just the product of neurons, right? Yeah. The neurons interact and produce the brain. The brain produces the mind. The mind produces, personality. Personality is combined to produce society. Society produces literature. And the highest product of literature is God. God is the highest product of evolution. Right? Yeah. Karl Marx, when he said religion is the opiate of the people, he wasn't being critical, because opium at that time was a useful thing. He said, it's a wonderful thing. Let's see what evolution has produced. Evolution has produced God. Wow. Evolution, God. Yeah. So that's one philosophy of life, very prominent. So the different things were going around. Jung had the fortune of being born in 1865, when these things weren't so locked in. There was still a lot of theology and a lot of flexibility. And from his childhood, because we're not coming into this, he said, nobody comes into this as tabula rasa. Tabula rasa. You know, tabula, slate, scratch, rasgar in Spanish. Nobody comes into this as a blank slate. Everybody who deals with babies, you know, right from the beginning, babies are different. Even when you're carrying the baby in your stomach, you know, some are tough, you know, complaining, whatever else. Some are, yeah, right from the very beginning, you can see there's a personality there. Some are terrified of everything. I knew one, Alexis, or my friend, Yashoda Rani's daughter, and she said from the very, very time that she could see anybody with a mustache, she would just freak out and start screaming and crying and everything else like that. You know, so on. And she said by about 6 years old, they go for walks in the market together. And somebody would pass by with a mustache, and she didn't start screaming and crying, but she could feel her holding on to her mother's hand tighter like that. So I mentioned I was using her in lectures and stuff. You know, she's a grown up now, everything. She said, yeah, it's a fact. I don't know why, but even still, I don't like guys with mustaches. So some trauma, something we're carrying for many lifetimes. So we come into this. So Jung came into this not believing that gross matter was the cause of all causes. He understood that there is some kind of like integrated seminal force behind this whole world, which is making it work. And he understood religion has certain aspects to it. You know? In our technical philosophy, there's Viratrupa, the universal form. And above that is Hiranyagarbha. And behind that is this golden, seminal, potent force behind it. And then finally, Paramatma, the Holy Spirit, like that, connecting it. And then you come to God as a person. You know, Paramatma is the hand of God. You see these things happening. You know, Lady Luck. Professional gamblers, you talk to professional gamblers, they have a developed sense of ethics and morality and intuition. Maybe a little perverted. Give everybody a free bottle of cutting shark. Okay. But they have some intuition. They can actually prove they live that way, knowing when it's time to throw the dice and when it's not time to throw the dice. And stuff. You know? This is Paramatma. You see the hand of God or the hand of goddess, you know? Or the trotter of Varaha, you know, in everything. Real. So he was on that level from a previous life. As a child, he was growing up in his culture and trying to integrate this stuff and everything else. And he wasn't satisfied taking religion as karma yoga, just the formal rituals, the formal paraphernalia. You know, Christianity means you go to the church on Sunday, drink the wine and the bread. Go to the temple, do your pranams, you know, offer incense. No, it's more than just the rituals and the paraphernalia. There has to be some intellectual comprehension there. Your intelligence has to be connected up like that. So this is Jnana Yoga. But he was beyond that. He was coming to this level of Jnana Yoga, appreciating you have to have techniques of being able to go and enter into this, enter into the kirtan, enter into the mystery of Jesus Christ in the form of wine, the bread like that and so on. But his father, he was a pastor, but he didn't have any of this. And so he actually died from frustration, because all he could get out of Presbyterian religion or whatever it was just the formalities. And even the intellectual stuff wasn't enough to satisfy him. So he died. And Jung then grew up, you know, in the village with his thing. And he had different mystical experiences back from a very early age. One time, for example, there was a loud explosion in the kitchen, and they all went in looking what it was, and they opened the cabinet up, and one carving knife, Swiss knife, you know, we got good knife here, good steel, had exploded. Right? Ever have it happen in your kitchen? Yeah, it blew up. You know. So he took the pieces to the local knife maker and asked him how it would happen, everything else. And the guy said, "Oh, you broke this up. How did you do it?" Because the guy would recognize how, you know, some kind of sawing or bending. He said, "How did you do this? I mean, you know, this doesn't happen. You know, it happened." You know. But there was some mystical stuff at that. So he was having different intellectual experiences. And formally, he was getting into psychology and realizing how these things are going on. There is a subtle body, there is a mind, there is intelligence. And they have their own life. Or maybe they're evolving, or maybe they're not. Maybe there's something coming from above which is actually influencing the formation of the gross body. And but he had nobody to deal with. He walked the same streets that Immanuel Kant walked. If you want to investigate Western philosophy from the point of perspective of a psychologist, Jung is your acharya. He investigated all this to a great, tremendous degree. He went back to the myth of the cults in Rome. He studied Kant and everybody else, and he knew Kant, like that sense of this guy walked these streets. Friedrich Nietzsche, very famous Western philosopher, he knew people who knew Nietzsche. So being an acharya in terms of Western culture, Western philosophy, I know Western history, Western philosophy, Western culture. Then he even was invited to go and travel to the United States. He was traveling across there, maybe about 1935. I think it was before World War II. And he was had a nice conversation with Mountain Lake, one Hopi shaman, like that, nice guy. A very, very famous dialogue, and they kept on exchanging letters after that. And in that time, letter meant like you write maybe a 5-page letter, send it off, and they take maybe 2 months or even 3 months to get to the Hopi Indian guy. He read it and wrote back to you. So actually it was an exchange of essays and so on. So what's happening now in the actual modern community is an actual people. You can meet these people, a lot of people in Western culture who are on this level of Bharat-Rup, introspection, meditation. Nobel laureates who are dealing with this stuff, who appreciate Jung and the Jungian tradition, what's happening. Even Nobel laureates, then and now. So what's happening, for example, is that a lot of Jung's works weren't translated that well. And even, for example, like Mountain Lake, right? His granddaughter may write to the Philemon Foundation, which is taking care of these things, and saying, I was going through my grandfather's stuff, and I was throwing a lot of stuff out, and I found these letters, it looks like, from your Carl Jung, and I was going to throw them away. Do you want them? Don't throw them away. So that's what's happening. There's still many things surfacing and stuff. So Jung was keeping a collection of notes on his own personal investigations, experiences. It was a book. Anybody know what the book was called? The Red Book. It was a big bound thing. He was an artist too. It was a beautiful calligraphy and colored drawings about his experiences from his introspective work. He was afraid of going the same way that Nietzsche went, because Nietzsche was going beyond impersonal categories to personal archetypes. The princess, right? The king, the merchant, the priest, all these things, the dragon. And he was going beyond these impersonal ones, these personal archetypes. Varna Ashram Dharma, Brahmana Kshatriya Vaishya Shudra, Brahmacharya Grihastha Vanaprastha. This is a part of the universal form. Right? It's not spiritual, it's material. Material world includes psychological elements which are very, very permanent. And actually more permanent than your gross body. You get the psychological body, it's going to cause the development of your next body, and so on. So these things he was experiencing, and then trying to put them in some kind of systematic fashion, and so on. So the Red Book, though, he was actually writing down his experiences with going into these meditative states. And he was afraid of going the same way that Nietzsche went, because Nietzsche went mad. Everything went nuts. Because he was afraid of going the same way, getting lost. So then when he met Freud, oh my God, he was somebody who believes in the same things, subconscious and these things. So he finally made an appointment to meet Freud. And Freud canceled all of his appointments for the entire day. They sat for 6 hours just talking about their experiences and stuff. And Freud was a little older than he was, maybe like 10, 15 years older. And they went on for some time. But then finally at some point, you realize that Freud really had his limits. He wouldn't accept paranormal phenomena. He wouldn't even come to his own grips with his own sexuality in some ways like that. A little bit obsessed. And then that morning he had to go on. Some very famous about their work together and their separation. And he's decided, okay, every day I'll have my practice in the afternoon, every evening I'll do with my family, in the morning I'll do my respective work, and that way it kept him grounded. So, but just before he left his body, everybody asked him, so many followers in the whole school developing, please write down your whole biography of your life's journey, what was going on internally and everything else. He said, no way. He said, but I bring out what I'm actually experiencing, all the theologians attack me and all the scientists attack me. I'm only a human being. I can't, you know, if I actually told them what I was experiencing, they would all just, you know, crucify me, you know, take out torches and stuff, you know. He said, please, please, please. Okay, so Anna Jaffrey, one of his, you know, female disciples, yeah, he then did this autobiography, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, like that. It's translated in many languages, and they're also very easy reading, very good reading. When you read these things as a devotee, you see, wow, it's just like Krishna consciousness. But here's somebody who's experiencing it. He's adding in more details, and this level is important for me. Okay, that's good. Yeah. And you can connect it. And then beyond that, you say you can, it's also good for our own psychology, your own psychological development, because we have problems, you know. Maybe you were in love with a rich man's daughter. So, yeah, he had these problems and stuff. So reading his books and stuff just helped. He has a way. So it's kind of a summary. So then Shonusham Dakshin, he was a professor of the history of medicine at the University of London, very much attracted to Jung, and very excellent historian, excellent guy. So he gave him the responsibility then of actually now finally translating the Red Book. Because Jung said, my biography, I'll do it, but it's not going to be published until after I'm dead. Yeah. So same way, years later, they're finally coming to this position where they're accepting that, okay, Jung probably was not psychotic. He was just describing the things the way they are. And we get a lot of benefit from that. So the Red Book came out a few years ago. And the Philemon Foundation is the one who's actually taking his letters and reconstructing so many things. It's a very active organization. There are union psychologists, different journals and periodicals. And so we've been lecturing all over the world in this area, which is science, psyche, and spirituality. The encounter of Carl Gustav Jung with the mysticism of ancient India, the Bhagavata, like that. And again, Umberto Maturana, his Nobel laureates, all Canada, it's all coming. And they know Jung, yeah, this is great. And now they're connecting it to India, wow. And they're satisfied. So we've been developing, I'm going to stop here. We've been developing a series of lectures. This gradually is growing. It's growing. Even the dog can take part. So over years and years we've been developing this area. It's very, anybody interested in this area? So we did, Peru is very, very good because Peru has enough ghosts and psychological stuff, and it's also close enough to America that you can really talk about science and spirituality very well. So we did a program with the National Library last year on psychology and the sacred. And it was so, international scholars, everything else, big people coming. And people standing 2 hours in line to get into the auditorium and stuff, the best auditoriums there. So then they wanted us to do it again this year, but I was going to skip it because 2018 we wanted to do a big program. It takes a lot of work to organize this. They kept pushing us, so we did it again. And this is, there was a poster then for Peru, psychology and the sacred. The National Library is right on one of the main thoroughfares, you know, 4-lane highway. And stuff. And they had a 40-foot-tall, you know, banner out there advertising this. And again, people coming, a lot of other groups coming together now. Jesuits, Sufi, nice people. I mean, we have so many areas where we can work together, which I appreciate that. And then we went to Chile. Down in Chile, we actually did, you know, specifically Jung, best cultural center in Santiago, you know, psychology. Another area we did, actually, so many times I was kind of bored of it, but they wanted us to do it again. This is Hamlet and Arjuna. It's not superficial. Two greatest works in the two worlds. Why are they so great? and so many deep things about philosophical perspectives. So again, it was a national library, a beautiful hall with marbles, with oak wood, packed full, head of the best television channel in the country, you know. And we were co-presenting with Raul Zurita, who's the national poet laureate, about 80 years old. When he was looking at me, I felt like anything I could do would probably occupy about 30% of his intelligence. This guy was a deep, intelligent guy. And he had translated Hamlet into Spanish. And he said, I just want to hear. I've met Hanuman Swami before. It's very interesting. Mahabharata's very interesting. I just want to come and listen. No, please participate. So beautiful cultural program, right? Music, kirtan. Yeah. Kirtan, kirtan lecture, kirtan prasad. That's the formula. Kirtan lecture, kirtan prasad. Music, very beautiful cultural program, high class. I gave my presentation on Hamlet and Arjuna. And then Rao gave some commentaries on it, but he read some selected things like that. I looked at the audience, and they were just like, you know, Hamlet's potent. Probably said you can teach Shakespeare in the Gurukula. There's a big discussion about remarriage. Is it okay to get remarried? Is divorce okay? If your husband dies, right? It takes sannyas. Is it okay to get remarried? Did Vishnu Priya get remarried? Lord Chaitanya took sannyas. No, she was first class, one grain of rice for each maha mantra. Okay. She showed she was just as good a sannyasi as he was. Okay. So, the glories of one name. But Parasara says, yes, following your departed Lord in the same fire of sacrifice, okay. And take sati, or become a civil widow, and yeah, okay. First class. Second class, still progressing in Kali Yuga, is enjoy life, but don't get remarried. Wear nice clothes, everything else. Third class is that after 6 years, get remarried. I mean, that person experiences with this. You know? So Hamlet is a lot about this whole thing about remarriage. His father, his uncle murdered his father, and the ghost tells him this, and he has to murder his uncle to get revenge. And he has to chastise his mother in no uncertain terms because she got remarried, you know, to her brother-in-law right after her husband was dead. His friend Horatio shows up and he says, oh, why have you come? I've come to see the funeral of your father. Funeral of your father. And he says, don't say you come to see the funeral of my father. Say you come to see the marriage of your mother. Marriage of my mother. And Horatio says, well, one did follow the other pretty quickly. Hamlet says, no, we should be thrifty. The cooked meats from the funeral feast did but do double duty as cold cuts at the wedding feast. His body wasn't even cold in the grave. Yeah. So in the play, the drama, you know, the queen is protesting, the other queen is protesting, I'll never get married again. And she says, they say a woman who kisses a second man in bed kills the first one twice. This is heavy, very, very potent. You know, yeah. And we can match it with Veda Vyas and stuff. And so again, it was very popular after people buy Bhagavad Gita like anything. And so on. So it's the kind of programs we've been doing. This cultural program is my nature. I've been developing this for a long time. Anybody here can probably develop their preaching much faster than I can. So, yeah. And we'll finish now. So from this side, from our organization, cultural organization, we've been down to developing, you know, Hamlet and Arjuna, Light of the Bhagavad. It's also a very, very good tool. How we designed it. And psychology and the sacred. And now we're going ahead with art and the sacred. We're trying to develop that for 2018. We're actually applying for, and we have a good chance of getting a $125,000 budget to make a movie on art and the sacred, Pilgrim's Progress. And we're working with very responsible, you know, people, directors of the Indian Fine Arts Academy, and people like that now. They're interested. And it's, again, how to relate to them. The Bhagavatam tells you. You can relate to dogs. You can relate to karmis, but you can also relate to jnanis. And also relate them to these jnanis who have their techniques and stuff. And these are our religious people. So we have Bhagavatam that allows us to communicate with so many people. And the more we can communicate with these, you know, higher class, more realized people, the more bigger our army of intelligent people is. If we can connect up with the Jesuits, we get an incredible number of Catholic people who, you know, Hare Krishnas are okay. You know? When it comes down to stopping abortion, right? Chaika was it. Parasara gives different atonements for different sins. Do this, do that, do this. He says for that girl who unnecessarily aborts her own embryo, no atonement is possible, because no way you can do anything to, you know, like expiate for this and have to suffer. You know. So he gives, it was a very bad thing, you know, so on. But now it's becoming legalized. So we start to find other people we can talk to, communicate. And there are details. We disagree with some. We disagree with the Balava Sampradaya. They see that the ultimate devotee, ultimate god is Krishna. And the greatest devotee is on your shoulder. Okay, Radha, your shoulder. Radha, yeah, yeah. So there are many details. And the other thing we're doing is we're working with the Ministry of Education. This is a book we published along with the symposium in South America, Solaris. So we're working with the Ministry of Education and, you know, developing different things with them, Bhakti Shastri, primary schools, and university programs, and that sort of things. So we're starting a magazine called Deep Labal, Revolution, a quarterly thing, and the first issue came out. And so anybody interested also in these educational programs, preschool, primary school, university education, because there are different franchises. I think even here in Woodland, somewhere here in Australia, somebody is doing Goloka education. And we're trying to connect all this. About 125,000 school-age kids in ISKCON right now. And we haven't even got our own school system. Montessori, what's the other one?
Steiner. Steiner is another
Steiner,
one.
Steiner, yeah, all these things are there. So kind of what we're doing, and tomorrow night we can maybe go on a little bit more about, you know, Carl Jung and the Bhagavata and these areas that they have preaching like that. So. And basically we're just trying to, like, inspire people. That's not my thing. But yeah, I can see, okay, if you develop that, I can develop food for life. That or somebody else. Or so many different areas. I used to work with the Bhakti Vedanta Institute. Yeah, and it's preaching to scientists. This is the most dry, you know. One time we had a big program with Nobel laureates, and one of the topics was consciousness one of the elements of the array of the state vector at the origin of the universe? Okay, well, let's say, speak their language. So many different groups and communities. So, stop here, any kind of final questions or comments? 6 o'clock,
I think. I was just wondering, as Srila Prabhupada said that there are 8,400,000 species of life. I was just wondering, where do microscopic living entities fit in microscopic creatures? Where do they fit into the...
We're broadcasting. The question is, probably the Vedas, Vedic literature, is a Puranas. So there's 8,400,000 species of life, where the microbes and the bacteria fit in. There are little I would call them worms, you know, the bacteria, but actually what they are is they're two-liter-shaped, motile living entities. That's a worm, you know? And they go on your skin. They drink out of your sweat glands, and they eat the rotting flesh. You know, feel good about it. All over our skin. Take a nice shower, you kill a lot of them off, they reproduce like anything. We've all been there, you know, having a good drink of the salty water. So, I'm not sure exactly, but that's where it comes in, that there are, like, it talks about aquatics and things like that, you know. So I'm not sure the worms, and worms are mentioned, and so on. So bacteria and small worms, big worms and small worms, you know. So I'm not sure exactly where it fits in that stuff. But they're conscious of these things.
We heard something for the first time that said, Krishna said, all is within me, but he is not within them. Now, this might be your visit, but every week we're told that Krishna is in all them. So we've suddenly got a contradictory statement.
This is the, not me, it's the Bhagavad Gita. The purport probably gives the example that the king has a ministry of health, ministry of education, ministry of prisons, ministry of defense. So he's not like physically present in every ministry, but by his influence he's present everywhere. So Krishna is present in everybody through his expansion of the Paramatma. Paramatma feature. An example is given, just like you look at many different pots of water, and you see the same sun is there. But the sun is in the sky, and these representations. So Krishna is saying in his personal form with Radha in Goloka, he's not present everywhere. But it's just like, for example, if I take a pair of tweezers and pull on Prabhuji's one hair on his skin, right? He's going to notice that. So every blade of grass, Krishna's the same way conscious of it. He's so big.
So sorry, I'm getting a contradiction there. Yeah. One minute you say he's not there, and then the next line you say he is there.
No,
you
said,
need clarity on, yeah, on how is, yeah, he not there?
He's not there, as I said, in his personal form like that, as Radha and Krishna.
Yeah, well, no one said he was. Yeah. We understand that he's, okay, small. If he's in a mouse, he's not 6 foot, yeah, tall.
Yeah.
He's squeezed in.
But it's not
We understand all that.
It's not even with the same form as Radha and Krishna.
You're not far off.
Well, no, he's there with
Krishna as a deity. He's pretty, looks pretty well identical to what you got up on the stage there.
Yeah. But Krishna in his Paramatma feature is present with four arms. And he doesn't have Radha with him. That's what we're saying. Yeah. Just like the king is present in different ministries through his expansions, his energies, his representatives, but not in his personal physical form.
So that was what you meant by that statement.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When he's not there,
he's not there in
personal form.
Yeah.
But he's there in influence.
He's there through his Paramatma, through his expansions, through his energy.
He's all pervading influence.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, okay.
Can we say
one,
that Paramatma is Krishna? Krishna is within me and within you, but we know him as Paramatma, but it's still that potent, wonderful energy. Except it's not me.
Brahma Samhita says, Premanjana Charita Bhakti Vilochanena Santasadaya Vridyeshi Vilokyanti Yam Shama Sundaram Chanta Guru Swami. So again, you know, I could take my danda here and start beating on Prabhuji's head. And he would say, why are you beating me? And I would say, I am not beating you. My cane is beating you. So Krishna expands himself as his Paramatma, which doesn't have Ananda. You can't have a relationship with Ananda with a Paramatma, only sadhan shit. But a devotee, he sees who's beating him. He sees, oh, this is the hand of Krishna, and I can kiss it, and I can and do things to it. You know? So it's quite difficult for devotees to understand the Paramatma, because you know, we see how Krishna did that. Somebody else, a gambler, he may see Lady Luck. I have that feeling again that if I put all this my money on the next roll of the dice, I can't hold anything back, and Lady Luck's going to do it. Yep. Again, it's there, that feeling. No. Papa says the Paramatma is form direction from the Super Soul. It's intelligence, perspective. There's a hand of God is in things, but is it a woman? Is it a man? Is it a pig? Is it, you know, it's a big beard? You know. So waking up, the devotee sees out as Krishna.
I want to know, how do you differentiate between your real nature and nature because of your previous impressions? How do we know what's our real nature and not because of the previous impressions we have?
Okay. One thing is that we have this kind of attitude, how do I do this? You know, we're like 3-year-old kids. We need someone to show us. We're always dependent energy. We do it by Krishna's help. In so many circumstances, even in this spiritual world, we're still functioning under Radharani's, you know, Shakti. Basically, Durga or Radha, take your choice. So even in the spiritual world, we're doing things from our nature, and it's integrated with Krishna, which shows the real reality of our nature through, you know, his transparent divine medium. Right? So it has to be, you know, we don't actually distinguish it all by ourselves. You know, Krishna's helping you. And the different stages in, but we're doing something too. It's like, you know, kids can cooperate, they can grow up. The first level is Anamaya, which is very interesting because you take Carl Jung, you give a series of lectures on the Kundalini, and you can just match it up, the chakras and stuff, with, you know, Anamaya. We're all born in the stage where we're just eating is everything. baby just wants to eat, and the whole world is like edible. You know? So he's identifying with everything. About 2 years old, the terrible twos, you start to realize that you aren't this world, you are this body. Right? I am this body. That's a big step up from thinking you are the universe. And it happens in animals too. And then, you know, if you try and cut the kid's hair, it's like World War III. They watch their fecal matter go down the toilet with all this stuff. They fight with their possessions. Many things in this world where you're starting to develop, distinguish yourself from your clothes, you know, and stuff, and distinguish your body. And so it happens naturally by God's arrangement if you're willing to participate in this whole thing. Next level is this anamaya, pranamaya, manamaya. And this is where we tell people, like, you know, something like, well, you know, a little Hindu boy can do that, but not a little Muslim boy. You know, or a girl, or a boy can do that, but not a girl. So you start to develop this thing, I'm a girl, I'm a man, I'm Hindu, I'm Muslim, I'm Japanese, this is all monodharma. And it's very extensive, very developed. Most people don't get beyond this. They're identifying with a certain society, a certain community, a certain species and stuff, you know. And it's there. Confucius is giving advice, you know. Confucius says, if you're going for revenge, better to dig two graves first. Yeah, so we're starting to come with wisdom and things like that, and social behavior, and how we act, and all these kind of things. And we're cooperating with all these authorities that Krishna gives. Krishna sent all over the world so many people, he's inspired them with knowledge, and you can follow them and apply it. Then, next level, Manomaya is Jnanamaya. Then you get to Confucius, Socrates, and all these wise people who are starting to say that the animals eat, the animals sleep, and what's the difference, and the sun rises, and you start to come to this, you know, level of seeing the universality and Brahman and things like that and so on. You know, and again, there's processes and people and different religions and so on. And finally, Anandamaya is where we have the possibility of actually Satchit Ananda, of having a personal relation with Krishna. You can't do it with Shiradakshaya Vishnu, you can't do it with Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. The first level where it can actually happen is with Mahavishnu. Shiradakshaya Vishnu and Garbhadakshaya Vishnu are expansions of Mahavishnu. They don't exist when there's no material world. Mahavishnu is the first one that God is great. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Al-Akbar, Al-Akbar. Number one, it's like Darshanarti. Shingarati, which never stops, just keeps on going forever, forever and ever, ever and ever, and ever and ever and ever. God, he's great, he's really great. This is Shantarati, you know, some people like that. So, and then again, there's different levels, there's different religions, different processes. And so in our culture, basically if you come to a certain level, then you realize, you accept Prabhupada as an acharya, you can guide me, accept him. And he tells you, chant this mantra, chant it on beads 16 times a day with enthusiasm, you know, 16 rounds a day, and follow four principles strictly. And that's all you have to do. But to chant enthusiastically, yeah, you gotta be up in the morning early. You can't be like having two rounds done before you go to work. Try and chant enthusiastic rounds, you're like falling. Yeah. So you begin to realize other things are essential. The Prabhupada gives a hierarchy, you know. Get up early, chant your round, read the Bhagavatam, join the Sankirtan movement. Yeah? And so we have our religion and process. And at a certain point, you realize there is an absolute truth. You become a Brahmin, second initiation. And at that point, you realize that all these non-eternal things are not, you know, myself. This is not obviously not myself, it's not eternal. You know? So you begin to look for that aspect of yourself which is pretty pervasive and going on all the time. You start to find it in yourself. The next level is Paramatma. You become a Goswami, Goswamini. Then you actually can distinguish you. It has form and stuff. And you start to find yourself in terms of your transcendental qualities and abilities like that and stuff. And these are abilities that my musical abilities are something I can tell which is very deep in my character. And even if I die, I'm going to be attracted to music and so on. Yeah? And then finally, pure devotee, then we have to go to Baba. And Baba before prema, you can actually distinguish yourself, you know, from eternal self. I am a mango. I am a cow. My name is Clarabelle. But you're just not, you know, you're not fully awake. You know? And when Baba manifested as prema, you know, I told you, and by Baba you're already distinguishing yourself. Okay? Yeah.
Just wanted to get some tips about chanting.
Yeah.
Like I've seen you chanting, I think you meditate on something with a picture in the morning.
Yeah.
What is the prasanna? What is the tip? What are the tips for good chanting?
Huh?
For good chanting, what are the tips for good chanting?
Wow. What are the good what are the tips for good chanting for you?
I want to know.
I guess because everybody's different.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is a good diet? You know, it's different. How can I honor prasadam? You know? I'm 70% pitta, pitta, fire element, you know? And so I have no gravity. It's like, ever see a fire with gravity? No, it's just my nature. I realize it, okay, it's just before I'm fighting. You know? So everybody's different, chanting is different. You know? But one tip, you know, somebody asked me like about 7 years ago, what is the essence of all this Krishna consciousness? And I was thinking about it, and I came up with seven words. Get up early and get your rounds done. Yeah. Yeah, you gotta beat it into your brains. Everything else after that is just easy. 16 enthusiastic rounds, first off, your intelligence is sharp, you're focusing, your mind is like, mind's like a muscle, you gotta work it, you gotta train it, and it's used to working nicely. So that's one of the main things. It's always better to be up early in the morning, engaging in kirtan, engaging in nice bhajan, samsara dhamma, mudika, know what the words mean, and then chant your japa, read Srimad Bhagavatam, and you're ready for your day and stuff like that. So beyond that, some people are 95% shudra, so they have to walk when they chant. Other people, they cannot focus when they're walking. Yeah? Somebody else is on and on. Sometimes I can't control my mind. My mind's running all over the place. So what I do is I stop breathing. Right? And my mind says, you're not breathing. I'm not going to breathe until you focus on the mind. I don't want to do what I want to think about myself. I'm not going to breathe. So there are many techniques. But the main thing is the desire to do it. So I think 6 o'clock we're supposed to have finished here. Thank you, everybody. If anybody has any questions afterwards, we can talk about it individually. But now, here is prasad. So, we'll be, I guess, getting class tomorrow morning and tomorrow night. Tomorrow's class?
Yes.
Okay, tomorrow morning, tomorrow night, and then Wednesday we'll be going to
Tuesday, Brisbane.
Well, Tuesday we'll be going to Brisbane. How do you say it?
Brisbane.
Brisbane.
Yeah.
Brisbane.
Yeah.